It's Thursday, February 3rd, 2011, and you're listening to episode 220 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
This is Johan.
My name is Pat.
All right, before we get this show started, we've got something a little bit different we're going to do. Johan?
We're going to drink? How's that different?
Because it's with a purpose. Johan, you want to explain what's going on here? We have in front of us each a glass of scotch, and there's a story behind this.
There is a story behind this. I have a very good friend who, for whatever unknowable reason, scotch was his favorite drink, and he passed away very unexpectedly 1 year ago today. When he did so, all of my old friends got together, and we agreed that on this day, wherever we were, we would lift up a glass of scotch and remember him.
And Johan just so happens to be with us tonight, so he brought a bottle of scotch. So from the Fear of the Boot crew to Willie, God rest your soul, man. This one's for you.
To Willie.
To Willie and to new friends.
And new friends.
And that is atrocious.
It's not nearly as strong as I thought it would be.
You know, it's iced down. If you drank it straight, it would be a lot worse.
I tell you what, guys, scotch and water, that's doable for me.
I've got scotch and water here, too. Scotch and cold water.
Yeah,
we let this ice down for a good long while.
I just did scotch and water.
I've had scotch before, and it normally is stronger than this. So water is the way to go.
See, this really pisses Dan off.
Yeah, you do this enough with your water thing. It's the middle of freaking winter. It is seriously like 18 degrees outside. The cold water coming through my pipes is probably colder than the water coming out of most refrigerators.
You know, it's because I'm not a damn dirty European. I like ice in my drinks. Go to hell.
Wow.
I should introduce you to my water cup one of these days, Dan, which is about a half gallon in size. And I put an entire tray of ice in it every time I fill it up. Which I do about three times a day, regardless of the season. So I'm with you, Pat.
You know, it smells and tastes kind of like paint thinner.
It pretty much is.
You know, amuses me so much is that there are a number of people who are listening to this right now who are the total scotch snobs. I'm talking when they drink their scotch, that pinky is at full mast as they drink it. That pinky's right up in the air. And they're like, ice? They're having it with ice? Oh no. I bet that's not single malt. That's 80 years old.
Let me put you at ease, guys. It's Cutty Sark. Ice is fine.
Those people just imploded.
They're weeping in their cars.
Yeah.
So now that we're full of piss vinegar and scotch, the banter topic that was tossed out for today, because our main topic is the one that we left sort of hanging at the end of the last episode on jumping into NPC roles. But the banter topic we've got is annoying RPG tropes, or RPG tropes that annoy us each individually. Who wants to start this one?
RPG podcasts.
God, I hate those.
Annoying RPG trope in RPGdom. They think they know it all.
Important jackasses who sit
Don't
around.
Worry, Johan, you're not real.
I know. I'm not a self-important jackass.
Well, in our average episode, we have four.
We usually do have five people on the mics.
We don't count Chris.
Chris doesn't count because he's too old.
Right. Demi-licious. He's all dead don't inside. Count as people anymore. Yeah. You get a bunch of self-important jackasses who just sit around with one opinion, dispensing absolute advice.
Yes.
To the listeners.
On games and topics that are totally irrelevant, that are like 80 years old, and that nobody plays them anymore because role-playing games have been around for 80 years. They just don't know anything. They just don't know.
Well, you know, I don't think it's RPG podcasts in general, because, you know, a lot of times when people come on the scene, they have fresh new ideas. It's really when they're there for a year or two and they just keep talking.
Yep.
All right, so I guess I'm going to have to go first.
What was the topic again?
Podcasting you can't put out episode 200.
I'm so glad Dan doesn't have a gun right now. Guys, I've known the man for 30 years. He's giving you the look. It's time to back off.
You know, I will have to say I've never seen alcohol go to people's heads as fast as this did. So I don't know what happened.
All right. So I'll start off then. Shaolin monks in medieval European fantasy settings.
Okay, where's the problem?
As an individual character, that's fine. You know, you're playing a European campaign and then there's the stranger from the East, and that's cool. That's something that you could work into a campaign. But as a normal
staple
character class that you're realistically supposed to maybe probably have one of these in your party,
right?
Like, not all the time, but most of the time, and that they're really cool. No, it's just something that is shoehorned in to a genre that doesn't need it.
It was
doesn't want it. And the only reason you're doing it is to pander to a certain kind of crowd that likes a certain kind of movie.
Yeah, you know, it was a pop culture fad in the early to mid 90s. And so it got shoehorned into a bunch of games, and it just does not freak
out. Oh, sir, you are seriously underestimating the age of that class. That was in the first edition PHB, printed in 1978. I have a copy at home. The best part, though, in my mind, of this shoehorned in class, you know, you might think, oh, well, this is just going to be the out of town Eastern monk. But it actually has in its level progression requirements that you must travel and battle the monk who is higher ranked than you in order to go up in level, which means it requires an entire temple and hierarchy in order to even function as a class as written. You can't have it as just the loner.
Yeah.
And you have to, in order to progress, do that. Was that Bruce Lee movie where he had to fight his way to the top of the temple?
That is Tower of Death.
Tower of Death. Yeah. So you have to play through Tower of Death each time you want to level up.
I want to play monk now.
One of the examples I gave of this off mic in my off mic rant was if you had a Wuxlu or sort of Shaolin Kung Fu, Bruce Lee Kung Fu role playing. You know, he was imitating birds when he did that. And the whole reason he did that is to throw off his enemies. It wasn't like I'm focusing my chi or something. He would make purposefully weird bird sounds to throw off the guy who's fighting, to kind of get in his head.
You know, another thing I hate about RPG podcasts is the tangents.
Yes.
God, I hate tangents.
So
the tradition's alive and well. Pat does it with ice.
So anyway, you have a, I mean, most people know where I'm going with this. You have this Kung Fu role-playing game, and you, instead of having the one character who is the stranger from the West, who is the European traveling Don Quixote knight, who's a man out of place, that's an interesting character, you have a character class that is the European knight in your game that is supposed to be there all the time. And instead of making
it's
an
like
interesting character once or twice, now this character is part of the game that's there all the time.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Sir Lancelot.
Yep. And there was a role-playing game.
So good that game.
Mm-hmm. There was a role-playing game that was like that, that had that. That was Legend of the Five Rings. It was an Asian. Now, that was more Japanese, but that was an Asian sort of martial arts role-playing game. One of the clans that you could play in there was a clan that had left, gone to quote-unquote Europe, and then brought back horses and knights and all that sort of stuff.
That sounds really cool to me, actually.
Well, yeah.
At least there's some attempt to do setting blending.
There was an attempt,
and they were influenced by something.
They were considered outcasts for it, but they were really powerful because they had this sort of horse culture and, you know, that sort of thing. Although
that sounds like a really good story, actually.
Legend of the Five Rings is a pretty cool setting, but didn't do what I wanted to in a role-playing game.
Succeed.
You know what? Somebody, and I'm sorry,
gain mainstream popularity, Pat. That is what Chad is after in every role-playing game he plays.
You know, I forgot. Sorry.
Yeah. I've mentioned several times that I bought into L5R when it first came out, and it didn't do it for me. And I've had actually multiple people email me and ask me, what is your problem with L5R? It's a great game. And you know what?
Scorpion Clan.
I agree with them. it is a great game. It's a great saying. It has a lot of support. And hell, the card games, you win a katana. What's cooler than that in the tournaments? But my problem with it was that when I bought it, at least how it was in the first edition, it had this great setting. It wasn't Japan. It wasn't Asia, but it was all influenced by, it's like D&D is all influenced by Europe, but it's not really Europe. And it has this great setting and all this history and tons of fluff and great production value and great art and all this stuff. But you could only play two classes. It was a class-based system, and you could either play a guy who kills stuff with a sword or a guy who kills stuff with lightning. And that's it. That's the only thing you could ever play.
I can't play a guy that kills stuff with a lightning sword.
No, you cannot.
I'm out.
Oh, well, now that you clarify that.
You can't play a village elder. You can't play a merchant. You can't play...
What do they kill stuff with?
They kill stuff with money.
Oh.
And then the village elder killed stuff with the power of old. So back to the regular topic here, or the topic we were on, of tropes in role-playing games that we absolutely hate.
When did we start talking about that?
One of the tropes that I hate, it doesn't matter what the genre is.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly I hate this in D&D fantasy stuff, but it could be in sci-fi, it could be anything like that. Dinosaurs.
I love dinosaurs, sir.
I too love dinosaurs. My son loves dinosaurs.
Yes.
And you could do a Land of the Lost type game that's about dinosaurs. But what I hate is you're playing a game, let's take our kung fu game, right? You know, there's the evil warlord and he's captured the village maiden who's your girlfriend, and you and your friends must use your kung fu to save her. And
a velociraptor comes out.
Yes.
As it should.
No.
Yes.
Should. No,
I'm sorry,
ever.
Sir. You
no.
just have no taste. Let me explain to you, sir.
Okay.
Yes. The best game ever written.
Okay.
I picked this up as actually a part of a promotional deal for an RPG magazine that promptly bombed, short story made long. But I got a whole bundle of indie RPG books with it. One of them was, hold on to your chair here.
Whoa. Okay.
We're going to start with a little bit of alternative history.
Okay.
We're going to go all the way back to the Civil War.
Okay.
In the course of the Civil War.
Wait, the real Civil War or like role-playing Civil War?
The United States Civil War.
Yeah.
Okay.
The late unpleasantness.
You know? Yes. The War of Northern Aggression.
Yeah.
For those of our Southern listeners.
Oh, that one.
Right, right.
I was wondering who would go there.
No.
I expected Pat.
In this version of this particular war, the South wins.
Yes.
Declares independence. There are now two major countries in what is now the United States. They both engage in the space race,
mm-hmm.
not Russia. The Confederates win the space race.
God, this actually sounds familiar.
Largely based on their ability to put together junky spaceships and get in them and fly, whereas the Union people were worried about safety and stuff. So they basically sealed up some pickup trucks and slapped some rocket engines on them and took off into space.
Now, is this like a steampunk sort of Jules Verne?
No, it is not.
Space, or this is Southern War, Independence, South wins, fast forward to 1975.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Confederacy wins the race to space, and I could be making this up in my brain, but I am fairly certain I saw an illustration in the book of a pickup truck with rocket boosters on it being launched into space. So, then, in the course of their colonization, in the course of their colonization of alien worlds, they land on one populated, sir, by dinosaurs.
Yes.
So it becomes a Wild West ranch hand dinosaurs in space, the occasional aliens, the random technology showing up wherever. You have people riding dinosaurs using laser lances to knock their opponents
here's
off
the thing.
Of
you
want
to know what I have to say to this? Why haven't you offered to run us a one-shot of this yet?
I'm a very busy man, sir.
Too busy for dinosaurs.
And I think it is all summed up in the brilliant naming of this game, Bronchosaurus Rex.
Oh.
So
even I groan at that name.
I am going to go ahead and claim victory in this argument, sir.
So here's my counterpoint. I mean, I like dinosaurs. I read a webcomic called Dr. McNinja, which a lot of people are probably familiar with. There is a character in there who rides a velociraptor. He was part of a gang that rode velociraptors. He was 13 years old and grew a mustache out of sheer force of will. So I don't have a problem with random velociraptors in silly games. In a serious game, I don't understand why
there's always a dinosaur island.
It's my general bitch with how people produce things. You have the 300. Mm-hmm. That movie came out. Obviously, the battle of Thermopylae.
Thermopylae. Yes.
Yeah. The battle of Thermopylae was not cool enough, so now we need to add ninjas and ogres to it.
They were there
and get all preachy about freedom and remove the 1,100 slaves that were fighting alongside the 300.
You.
Yeah.
So you have like Shadowrun. My inherent problem with Shadowrun is cyberpunk is not cool enough. We have to add elves, and it's just this idea that you have things that the base concept is cool. And to be different with it, you don't have to shoehorn in another concept.
All right.
Fantasy's cool. Why do we have to add land and loss to it?
My counterargument for that, sir, is one cool plus two cool equals at bare minimum three cool, if not four cool.
I have actually found the sort of string theory of that argument. I cannot prove it because we do not have the resources or the financing to prove my calculations is that one cool plus two cool equals a plate of dog vomit 9 out of 10 times.
You know why that's a string theory? Because it's easily cut. I'm on Johan's side here. I want to see dinosaurs.
I'm on Chad's side. I've always been a believer that if you don't think reality is cool, you don't know enough about reality.
Yes.
That if you have to take reality and add in a whiz bang. I get why that works in certain titles. If that's what you want out of a game, I totally get that.
And yeah, there is no bad, wrong fun.
Yeah, exactly. And there are games I play that have absurdist elements to them of a wide variety of types. But if you do it purely because your sole stated reason is because if we took reality and added this, it would make reality cool.
Yeah.
You don't know enough about reality and history to understand how cool it already is.
Yeah, but he's talking fantasy games. We're already not dealing with reality. We're dealing with orcs and trolls and all these other creatures. Why not dinosaurs?
All right, so Wayne, you started talking, so it's your turn.
I got nothing. I can't think of anything in any of the games I've played that have really fallen out of place like that.
That's because you've never played Spelljammer.
That's true.
I love Spelljammer.
You would. Giant hamsters and all, huh?
F and A, sir.
You can buy a space hamster in Mass Effect 2. It even says in the description, like, when you look at it, it nods at you knowingly.
Awesome.
Pat, what about you?
I actually don't have anything either. I've not played some of the weird ones you've mentioned, like Spelljammer or anything. So, or even, really, I've never really even played, like, Cyberpunk, so I don't even have that experience under my belt. But nothing's really ever just struck me as weird. I like all the weird. And like what you're saying, I disagree with what you said about how cool reality is. I understand that, but we're talking about playing fantasy games, like you said, Wayne.
Well, right.
At its essence, we're playing a fantasy game. Trying to make it as realistic as possible, it's still fantasy.
That wasn't the point I was making. Mm. The point I was making was that I play Battletech. Faster than light ships and giant robots don't exist. I'm not saying every game has to be tied to reality. I'm saying what annoys me is when someone feels they have to permutate reality for the sole reason that reality alone is not cool enough. Not because they're trying to be fictional, but because they think this wasn't cool enough, so we have to add in things that weren't really there, shouldn't be there.
It's a cheap out for a writer, is how I see it.
Yeah.
Is that you take a genre, even one that's fantastic, and you're taking something that's cool, which is the genre, and you need, as a writer, as a creator, to do something different and original with that. I get it. And I get that that's hard to do because everything under the sun's already been done. So what you do is you take this other thing that you think is really cool and you slam it together, whether it fits or not, whether it works or not, and you say, look at this. I have this thing. It's two things that aren't original smashed together. Now it's original. And it's like, no, it's not original. It's lazy writing.
Where do you think genres come from, sir? I
think genres come from a natural evolution, a blending of these things over time is where genres come from. Not somebody sitting in his attic and going, oh my God, I need a hit. Oh my God, I need a hit. Elves and computers, cyberpunk. Everybody loves cyberpunk because it's 1982 and it's really hot right now. And everybody loves elves. And if we combine the two, it'll be awesome.
You know, the funny thing is I hear all this talk about cyberpunk. I don't think I've ever experienced cyberpunk in any media. I don't think I've ever watched a cyberpunk movie.
You've never seen like Strange Days, Johnny Mnemonic,
Blade Runner.
No.
Matrix had a lot of cyberpunk elements, elements to it, but
that's the thing. I don't know what falls under cyberpunk element. If Matrix does, that would be the first one you've mentioned that I've actually seen.
Well, Matrix, it has elements.
It sounds like Chad and I are making somewhat
different. It's almost like the Matrix took the cyberpunk genre and mixed it with something else.
It made something awesome if it did.
Yeah. And look what happened there. Matrix 3.
I know of no such movie, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's all right because their talk in the last few days that... Keanu Reeves is pretty sure that they're talking about Matrix 4 and 5.
I thought I heard
they haven't even made the second one yet.
4 and 5.
Excellent. I think that's a fine idea.
That was a hoax or a joke.
It may be. I saw that today.
They lost their ass on Speed Racer. They have to make up the money somehow.
Yeah. So it sounds like Chad are making slightly different points, but the genre mashing...
But we're both right.
Bingo. Colors.
But I will give you the genre mashing brought us the Will Smith Wild Wild West, and that was god-awful horrible.
No. Actually, that was based on an old TV show.
The one that they made, though, the movie, was steampunk meets Western.
Yeah.
The TV show was
Western, sir.
My sole point
You know
is
what?
That,
I don't know. I'm just going to interrupt Dan.
Yeah.
Did you know that I made that point on the show like a year ago that the vast majority of steampunk out there, now this is a little different now because so much steampunk has come out, but when I said it, the vast majority of steampunk that I've seen is Wild West, and everyone's like, no, it's not, it's Victorian. And it's like, when do you think the Wild West happened?
That was more like 3 years ago, and you were right then, and I'm still right now. So,
Johan, colors.
Once again, there's very few steampunk I've ever seen.
All right. When you guys are done grabbing each other's asses over victory here, can we move on with something actually of substance?
Maybe a genre I've actually experienced.
Here's one. Nice. Yeah. Enough ball fondling going on here.
All right, we're just going to take the genres of ass grabbing and ball fondling. We're gonna slam them together.
And we're going to pound them together. Yeah. Yeah. Chad will love it.
So we are doing a genre I've experienced.
We're going to go see our proctourologist. If one of them helps make you healthy, a magic combination.
And you know what? At the end of this, I will be proven right because at the end is just a big sloppy mess.
So, all right, I got at least one more in May.
Okay.
I'm already bracing myself, though, to deal with some of the people who completely misconstrued my point on the fantasy thing, but we'll come.
You hate that.
I know.
I love it, too.
We'll
you just
deal
get
with
so,
it when it happens.
You shake your little fist in impudent rage. Like, oh, they don't understand me, and I speak so clearly.
And sonorously.
Yes.
It dies on a 20, and they don't get my nuance. So, all right. So here's another one. The reuse of an enemy by color or region. Examples. Dragons are an obvious one, but they do this with everything. You take a dwarf or an elf or an alien or whatever, and all of a sudden you turn one enemy into 20 by giving them different geographies or different skin colors, and now all of a sudden they're completely different and restatted monsters are totally different except exactly the same. Now, I understand why they do this in video game. It's a budget.
Or at least they used to do it.
They still do. Yeah. It's a budgetary thing. They take a model, they recolor it, they resize it, they slap on horns, whatever, and they reuse it as a way of saving art budget. I get why they do it in a video game. But in a role-playing game, especially when that is applied broadly to aliens and monsters, it's not just, oh yeah, this one type of monster has a bunch of subtypes, but this becomes the norm for your rogues gallery.
You know what? I'm just going to take this right back to what you said earlier about more of the realism. In my mind, that's just keeping it closer to on Earth, so to speak, and the fact that there are subcultures within races. I mean, there are differences in each country. There are different stats, whatever, that you can set them out in a gameplay, but they're all essentially people.
All right, but here you're talking about cultures or maybe technological availabilities. But if you were to stat this out as a monster in a monster manual, there would still be one human entry with one set of stat ranges. And then down below it, you would just have a description of the cultures or technologies they might have access to. There would not be differences so substantial.
Well, but maybe not. Okay, in that aspect, maybe. But if you've got a game where it's more than just one entry, just humans, it's 15 different entries for humans. It's, to me, that would be more of a realistic setting. It's instead of having these fantastical monsters, you've just taken a small subset of like maybe 5 or 10 different races. And in those different races, you're statting them out like that, like with dragons. So for me, I don't know. I don't have a problem with it because, again, it's more realistic. And that's what you like. That's what you said.
I think it's cool if it's on the same sheet. But I'm with Dan. If it's the same thing on a bunch of different pages, if I get punched by a German guy, I get punched by a Mexican, I don't care what race they were when they punched me. I got punched by a guy.
Your objection is based on how many pages it takes up in the book?
No, it's. I don't think it deserves its own entry.
It becomes lazy. Okay. Yeah, instead of distinguishing cultures or technology levels.
It's a footnote, not a new entry.
Exactly. You're now trying to recycle. You're just recycling. It's just lazy.
But at the same time, I mean, honestly, the difference between a Sylvan Elf and a Moon Elf in D&D is a footnote in the heading Elf. Much like if you were going to make a D&D is modern day campaign, you could have a separate sub-entry for Norwegian and Japanese, because Norwegians tend to be about a foot taller and weigh an extra 100 pounds. And I'm sorry, if I'm going to pick one to get punched by, so, I know which one I'd pick.
So Johan, you're calling Norwegians fat?
I'm calling Norwegians tall, sir.
Oh, okay. Yes. So they're
I've seen girthy. The 13th Warrior. All right. I've seen Norwegians, Spaniards. I know how it works out.
I do have to agree with Dan, though. I get tired of there's the green dragon and the red dragon and the blue dragon, and each dragon is something different. It just gets to me, because you have to keep track of what each one is, how you're reacting to each different kind. And
have you actually ever played? Have you ever played in a fantasy setting with the different types of dragons, though?
No, not in a game. It's just, I have that problem with fiction, because I've seen that in different kinds of fictions, and even the new Doctor Who has different colored Daleks. That bothers me.
Yeah, well, that should bother you, because it's wrong. But anyway,
I keep expecting Skype to ding with Tracy Hickman calling up to defend himself vociferously.
Oh, but
against
Pat,
the slander.
Different colored Daleks is more realistic because
there's swamp Daleks and mountain Daleks and
exact cave Daleks and
Norwegian Dalek.
Dalek loves wondrous variety.
That was the wrong movie. That was Robin Hood.
Yes, I know.
Warrior. Okay,
I know that. Okay. Yes. So now that we've probably gotten enough ire worked up.
Send all hate mail to Johan at feartheboot.com.
Yes. Did we give you one of those yet?
No. That's the beauty of it.
Yes.
You know, one of these days I'm going to say that. And he's going to set one up, forward it to my Gmail. And I have 180 messages.
All right, so let's move on.
Fourth edition sucks. Send that to Johan.com. And Dan's like, oh, yeah, motherfucker.
You realize this is all your fault for bringing the scotch.
I'll take credit.
Yeah, I know. What's funny is I think you were even one of the people that helped set this topic up. And then, I love everything. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Everything in RPGs is wonderful.
Everything is. I mean, that's, you guys
Dan
are crazy.
And Chad are just negative Nancys.
They really are. I was really surprised by that. I mean, good Lord, they really were closed-minded.
Mm-hmm. And like a steel trap. To get us to talk about this, I mean, I've still got the marks on my back. Yeah. How about you?
Yep. Well, I like those marks. Wearing my badge.
So the topic we left hanging from last time was jumping into non-player characters. And to re-explain this for anyone that is either picking up the podcast for the first time and still listening, or...
We're so sorry.
I don't even think we're still listening at this point.
Doesn't recall exactly what it was we were talking about. We were discussing, there's a scene going on, and your character is either not involved or is certainly not in the forefront. So it's not like you're the person the GM's interacting with. The party's on a space station.
You fools split up.
Yeah, which parties invariably do. And one guy's in a shop and Chad's role-playing somebody in the shop. And let's say Pat's the only player character there. So as a way of both, number one, adding color to the scene, and number two, keeping us involved so we're not jacking around with phones or flipping through rule books or whatever, the rest of us can jump into a non-player character and help add color to the setting. So, for example, Chad's playing the shopkeeper. I might just jump in as the annoying lady stuck in line behind Pat, who's yelling at him to hurry because my two kids are making a fuss in public. And Johan jumps in as the shopkeeper's assistant or whatever the case might be.
Is he a swamp shopkeeper? Because I'm more of a mountain shopkeeper.
And I don't jump in at all because, see, like I said last episode, this is a completely foreign concept.
A kung fu old lady in line, you know, from the Shaolin Temple.
Luckily, I'm riding a velociraptor.
Don't make me pull out my lightning sword.
Is that what the kids are calling it these days?
So, you know, and this idea of jumping into an NPC is just as foreign concept as everything else they just mentioned to me.
Dan and I used to do this NPC jumping in thing, whatever you want to call it, a lot.
Yes.
Back in the old days when we played awful, awful role-playing games as teenagers. And then when we sort of matured to more the highbrow video game, role-playing games that we're more accustomed to now, the kinds with heavy role-playing and not quite as much combat that we espouse in the show. And it was never something that we just sat down with our group and said, you know what would be cool? If so-and-so played the bodyguard of the ship's captain that's going to come out and start, you know, menacing you. Wouldn't that be neat? Because so-and-so is in the brig right now and he can't role play anyway. No, it just sort of happened.
Yeah, we just started doing it. And I don't know why we started doing it. I know why we stopped. The reason we stopped was simply because...
Well, you and I stopped being friends.
Well, we switched groups.
Yeah.
And in both of the groups that ended up forming out of that, this just wasn't a custom.
Yeah.
Because my group was a harsh mistress, and your group really was uncomfortable with role-playing.
Well, they were all new.
Many of them were uncomfortable with role-playing. Yeah. And so it's just a tradition that just kind of petered out and died as there was turnover within the groups. But it was something that really added a lot to the game for the two reasons
I gave.
One, it gave color to the scene. And once again, two, it kept people involved. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I would love to see us do again in our game. In fact, I have committed that the next time we actually get a game going, should be this Sunday.
Two months.
Yeah.
We're gaming on the Sunday, come hell or high water. But, Johan, you're not invited.
But I've made...
Because you're just going to bring Velociraptors.
Yeah, and you'd play him, Scott.
And you'd want to play a monk.
Cyborg elven monk atop a Velociraptor.
With a lion.
Our campaign is missing
in
one
this
of those.
Game.
But I'd allow it.
Yeah, I have to say, in their current game...
Maybe a deck or two.
In our current game where you jumped into an NPC that was one of your NPCs, that threw me. Because that was even a new concept. Like, wow, Chad's letting him play multiple characters here? That was my mindset, because this is a completely foreign idea to me. I don't even know how this works. I don't know how you pick a character to jump into. I don't know how you keep from confusing everyone at the table when you do it.
Well, and Wayne, that right there is a major distinction. When I did character jumping in that game, I had one major and two lesser player characters. And the way I'm drawing that line is these are characters who I had prepared and who are under my control, not Chad's.
Yeah. I don't really even hardly know anything about these characters. He sent me write-ups I never read. So
I have, you know, write-ups and personalities and stat sketches and things like that, as opposed to jumping into the shopkeeper's husband or something like that, where this is completely blind for me. This is not something I've prepared to do. I'm just doing it. And Chad is the game master. And this is where it requires a certain degree of trust and collusion, is going to have to accept that I'm going to influence the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I
hope you do.
And I certainly, I think, have to watch him for cues, because if he's about to drop a major plot point, I have to be prepared to defer to that. And we'll talk about that more as we develop the subject. But the big difference, once again, is that this is something you do spur of the moment, purely on impulse, unprepared.
Yeah, I think at the very heart of it, it's improv. I mean, that's just the easiest way to say it. It's just like you're doing some improvisational acting. It's not anything that's planned. It's not your own character. It's just you throw a scene out there, you throw two characters out there and say, go. And that's what you're doing. It's not familiar to you because you've never seen any of us do it.
No.
I've done it in the past, too, and it's worked very well, and it's a lot of fun for the reasons they've already mentioned. It really adds to it. And beyond adding to the scene itself, what I really think that it's done, at least for me in the past, is it invigorates me. I loved doing it because it's so fun. It's so different. It's a tangent in a way, but it's like it's so much different than what I've been doing. I get a chance to take a break, albeit momentarily, from my character and play something new and fresh. And just something that simple can really keep you going sometimes. And that's why I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if this is something you want to start in your group, the game master can encourage it by turning to players they trust in particular and saying, for this scene, I want you to play the king's bodyguard.
Yeah.
And just say, go with it. And if this is someone who's good at that sort of improv role play and you've got some history there, they'll probably pick right up on it. And you just start playing the king, and whatever they do as the bodyguard, you just incorporate into the scene. And one thing that Chad was suggesting last episode is that you could even, to a certain extent, once again, this depends on the game master, how comfortable a game master is with this, let them develop the plot a little bit, and that if they say something like, Your Majesty, we should get you inside as I see storm clouds coming in, well, the game master just rolls with that and says, okay, it's starting to rain. Or it could be something much bigger than that of, Your Majesty, I think I hear gunfire in the distance.
Again, there's no collusion going on between the player and the GM, and the GM and the player says, oh, Your Majesty, I hear thunder in the distance. You better go inside. And I say, okay, let us adjourn to the inside. And the players say, are there any storm clouds? And this game master, I go, nope. And you know what? You gotta roll with that. What just happened there? So I think if you're really comfortable with improv and kind of thinking off the cuff, that's pretty cool. As much as I love collaborative games, as much as I love improv role playing, as much as I love that whole and but thing where the players just really take hold of the story and plot and really start running with it, I don't really feel 100% comfortable with that situation. You're out on the balcony of the castle and you have the king and you have the king's bodyguard and you have two of the players there. I'm not 100% comfortable with a player jumping into the king.
Oh, I'm absolutely not. As a player, I would never jump into a major NPC. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you even would want me to. I would. Yeah. I just wouldn't feel comfortable, because if it's that major an NPC, then I think that's got to come from you as the game master, because a player could do something that could just totally throw a wrench in what you're going to do, or just it's 180 degrees off or whatever.
I think
it's just too dangerous, and I am not comfortable doing that.
I think it's dangerous because you can poke an eye out. But I think that my problem with it is that if you're doing a good story, there's an element of unknown. There's an element of mystery. There's an element of just things going on that the players don't know yet, right? And if you're jumping into a major NPC like the quote-unquote king, that king knows things that the players and the characters do not. So it's not a matter of the players can't make stuff up in improv. That would be really cool. But it's a matter of they're missing certain aspects of the puzzle. Right. And I'm not afraid of the puzzle getting rearranged or even messed up, because it's half messed up in my head anyway. The picture in my mind only comes into focus as we're playing, but it's just that I think that the players would be at a disadvantage. The whole thing is that the players have a really good time and that they're not uncomfortable and they're not reaching and they're not struggling with a player asks the king, who is being played by another player, a plot relevant question, and then every 5 seconds, the player who's playing the king is looking at me, who's playing the bodyguard, going, what color is the dragon? Are we being attacked by orcs? Is there a plot to kill this king?
And that, you know, it breaks really immersion. Kills immersion being the player. Or if the player just drops something and you have to pull them back, it's like, no, that didn't happen like that. That kills immersion.
Oh, see,
for me.
And that if I had to do that, if the players drop something and then I'd be like, oh my God, that changes everything, I would actually roll with it instead of telling them, no, he didn't say that. And
I think
there's a lot of people who have a problem with
that. You can roll with that by saying something like, bodyguard may be misinformed.
Well, is the king misinformed?
Or outright lying. Or, yeah. I mean, there might be ways you can roll with it. But I came up with sort of three guidelines that I think help smooth this out. And all of these really are subheaders of one guideline.
Scotch.
Dinosaurs.
Damn it! Scotch and dinosaurs.
Now we just start mixing genres.
Crap.
Respecting the game master and respecting the story that they are trying to tell. But the three specific guidelines I put here is, number one, accept that the game master can veto your actions.
And the way I would run that, I am so against the game master vetoing actions. That's one of those things that on paper, you're absolutely right. It's totally logical. All reasonable people would generally agree with that. I cannot agree with that because A, I'm not a reasonable person, and B, it breaks.
He's an honest person, though.
It breaks immersion. Great role playing. Great role playing. Dan comes in with me and Johan and this king, and we're role playing and role playing. It's great. And then suddenly Johan says, well, and blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, stop. You can't say that. Rewind that. No.
I absolutely agree.
That sets my teeth on edge. It's so immersion breaking.
But see, for me, and you're talking about the immersion, and going back to the thing you're talking about before, like with the king, with a major NPC, what I see as a problem is if you let one of the players play that king for a while, at some point, you know, as the game master, I'm going to have to be the king because I have to convey some information. To me, that would be just as disjarring as step in and say, okay, Johan, I need to take over the king now.
I think one of the ways around that, I'm going to say in our Sunday game, that you guys can jump into the important characters. We're going to try that. If the scene comes up and you guys want to jump into important characters.
Well, that's easier because Pat's the king, so.
What I would do in that situation is, as it's coming up, I have note cards. And I'm going to scribble something really fast and then pass it to you. And that'll contain the pertinent information. But...
Well, and I would certainly agree that if you get to the point where the game master has to veto your action, you've probably already overstepped either guideline two or three, which I haven't gotten to yet. And that's fine.
We'll Scotch get them and dinosaurs?
Totally. Yeah. We'll get to them in their good time. But the game master generally should not need to do this. But they always have that right if it's necessary. Johan, you were going to say?
Well, actually, I had a couple things. First is cyber ninjas.
Gotta need scotch to wash that out of my mouth.
Cyber ninja monks riding on a velociraptor.
Nah, see, that's ridiculous. Awesome.
I like the idea of these cues and possibly even plot points, because I would be afraid that these would just become tangent after tangent after tangent of people jumping in, which
that
can
never
be,
happens.
It can be cool roleplay, but
what games you play? That's 90% of my content.
That is true. But I mean, we've been stuck in that rut of we're not moving the story along, and we've been in this spot for far too long. And I would just be afraid of that happening with everyone jumping into NPCs, like say in a bar situation.
That's an absolutely awesome topic we need to discuss and sometimes. How much role playing is too much role playing?
I actually would totally not fear that. In my experiences as playing and GMing, I would love it if I was running a game and my entire plot was derailed for an entire session by the players role playing with each other in a bar and having a great time doing it.
We actually
I'm going to go take a nap on the couch and you guys have a blast and we'll meet next week.
That's really cool once though. Yeah. But if you tangent 1 week and then the next week and then the next week and the plot's not moving on and your players start saying, we're really not accomplishing anything.
Well, I would,
because we've seen that.
Bad GMing, blow something up.
I would take this back, Wayne, to
Cyber Ninja.
Rule one of FTB 9000 compliant gaming.
You will not speak unless spoken to?
No, that was Meek's rule. And rule two is you will call me daddy. But no, it's the only way to lose at a role-playing game is to not have fun. The only way to win at a role-playing game is to have fun. If it has ceased being fun, if this has become such drudgery because you can't get through any shop without everybody dogpiling the scene, yeah, it needs to be put back in perspective and you need to move forward. This needs to be toned down. There needs to be a discussion amongst the group.
And I really don't think it would come to that normally because I think everyone's not having fun doing it,
they'd stop doing
it. No one's going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. They'd stop doing it.
I think the only real risk that you're going to have with that is if you have that guy. You know, that guy who's going to jump in on every single scene and everyone else at the table goes, oh my God, just shut up.
Well, yeah, that was,
and then, you know, you have a beat down and it's fine.
Yeah. That's one of the other things I would be worried about is that if you have a group of, say, five or six people and four of them think this is a really cool idea and they all jump in and the fifth guy is a guy that you know, like in our current group, we have someone that isn't as comfortable speaking in character as the rest of us.
We'll break them.
Yeah, exactly. If we started something like this, that person might not get as active in the game as everyone else, and eventually leading to that person being ostracized and,
made either, fun of, and then we do a red alert on them. And
well, I think for us, that's great because that gives us episode topics for weeks to come,
and something to do with all those bars of soap that you've got lying around the house.
But for other people, I would think that could be a concern.
That's all I bring to any game is my dice, a sock, and a bar of soap.
Who doesn't? I mean, that's standard equipment in the D&D DM bag. But one thing I think that would really fall back to, though, Wayne,
wait. Are you saying soap is standard equipment for a D&D player?
Yeah, but only not in for washing.
Okay.
I mean, an orange works, too.
There's
options, or a half brick. But one thing that I really think, Wayne, that it really goes down in the case you're talking about to the DM being able to know the players well enough to stop it. Because the DM ultimately has control of the scene. And regardless of whether he's let the other players take over NPCs in the area, and there's a crazy shopkeeper, and there's screaming children, and whatever everyone else is doing, cyber ninjas, but there remains the possibility that somebody's going to kick in the door and say, there's a fire down the street, I need help. And then all of a sudden, that stops the scene, and the guy who's sitting over there at the table, not doing anything, can suddenly leap up and say, hey, I've got firefighting of rank 8. I'm on the job, or whatever it is that that guy is into. You just have to be able to pull it out, you know?
Yeah.
Throw it on the table and say, hey, I'm going to toss this guy a bone.
I think that's the thing, is that there is a world that is happening independent of the PCs. The PCs may have varying degrees of influence or control over that, from none to a huge world-altering amount. But, I mean, this isn't even advice for people jumping into NPCs. This is advice for any time your game slows down.
Or running a game.
The world is moving regardless of what the PCs are doing.
The other two guidelines I have, and I think both of these would help feed back into keeping the GM from needing to veto your action, is number two, have common sense about which NPCs are off limits. Don't jump into the big bad. Or without
I kill myself.
Yeah, exactly.
I tell the PCs, you brave heroes have arrived. My only course of action is to swallow my own tongue. Please distribute my magical items and great wealth amongst yourselves.
Also, you may notice the cache of artifacts that I have hidden under the third brick to the left of my altar.
Now, I bid you good day.
You know, I just keep going back to thinking about Pat doing this, jumping into the barmaid to sleep with all his characters. Because I could see him doing that.
And, you know, when in doubt, ask the GM. I don't think it's scene-breaking real quick to say, do you care if I grab this guy? Because he was like, yes or no, and you roll right on with it.
That actually is my big question. How do you do this? Let's say I've got this situation set up. It's a bar full of cyber ninjas.
The social...
Yes.
Sort of Chad, polite way of doing it.
I have a bar full of cyber ninjas. Chad, you want to be the bartender. How do you do that? Do you
say you're running the game?
Yes. I'm running the game. How do
Am I a cyber ninja?
No, you're
a velociraptor.
You want to jump
but
into
I'm
the bar.
But I'm stabled outside.
Yes.
Okay.
We don't serve your kind in here.
This is the Confederacy.
Just start talking? Do you...
How I would do it and how Dan would do it, two totally different things. And how I would do it is I would just start doing it. I would just say, I am the bartender, blah, blah, blah. Or I would say, well, the bartender cozy up. What the hell are all these cyber ninjas doing in my Wild West game? Get the hell out. No, I mean, I would just start role playing the scene. I would want to be as natural as possible, and that might make it uncomfortable, but I don't care. Now, Dan, who is far more diplomatic than I am, I would imagine you would say, hey, Wayne, you mind if I jump in the bartender? You'd mishear him and say, your character wants to jump the bartender. And then he would roll with it. He's like, yeah, I do. He's an attractive man. What's wrong with that?
Here's something that I think that we've lost sight of. And I know that you're going to disagree with me, and I'm pointing at Dan and Chad, but I don't care because this is the way I feel. I think there are a few simple... I've got a few quick rules about how I would go about jumping into an NPC. First of all, I look at NPCs as... You've got your primary NPCs, and then you've got your secondary and maybe even tertiary or whatever. My rule is I, as a player, would never jump into a primary NPC. I would only go for secondary or lesser NPCs. And then the other rule that I have is if my character is in the scene, I'm playing my character. I'm not jumping into an NPC.
Absolutely.
The only reason I, as a player, will ever jump into an NPC is if I'm split from the party and my character is not here and it is an opportunity for me to still be role-playing with the group. Because you're sort of hitting on some things, Wayne, where
you go into a bar. Of how do you do
this? Yeah, we're going to a bar and a whole party's there. How do I jump into the bartender? Now, the answer is you don't.
Now,
you
play your character. Actually,
I told you they'd disagree with
you. No, that's my question. Which part of this did you think I would disagree with? I completely agree with you.
I think maybe it's Chad, because I think Chad was sort of going down the road of, if you're all there, you can take a break, not play your character, play an NPC.
Let me give you an example from a recent game.
And I don't think that you should. Let me give you characters, or you don't.
Let me give you an example from a recent game. Johan is familiar with this example, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so you guys are all in the castle, and you're in this big dining hall, and you're discussing the politics of the realm. And it's an interesting conversation. Lots of face-to-face role-playing, lots of in-characterness. Wayne's character is a bard who's aloof and who, quite frankly, does not give 2.5 craps about your political problems. And he's role-playing as character of being aloof, and I'm tootling on the guitar, not listening, not saying anything, maybe throwing out a one-liner. For the most part, for 90% of it, Wayne is totally in character, it's totally awesome, and he's totally not doing anything. There are other NPCs around. At that point, Wayne can say, I am doing these really awesome things of not doing anything, and now I jump into one of the NPCs, the captain, the guard, whatever, and now I'm interacting, now I'm doing FaceTime, now I'm doing, you know, now I'm doing the role
play. Yeah, so when I set this up, one of the things that I said was, I would only recommend this if either your character's not there or your character is faded way into the background. Right. I completely agree with you, Pat, that if your character is there and ought to be active in the scene, that should be who you're playing. You should not be trying to play the world. That's okay. The GM's job.
I just felt that in our conversation, it had sort of evolved to the point where we were... I just got the feeling that we were talking more on, okay, especially like with your comment, Wayne, whereas you go on for 2 or 3 sessions where you're just doing the minutia of playing in the gaming store. It's like, well, I don't think that would happen because where the hell are your characters while you're playing all these NPCs?
That's a damn good question.
They've gone on with the plot. That's where they are. They've continued.
The world still keeps going.
They've actually finished.
These are buying a book at a bookstore.
They got bored with their players and they left because you're playing the goddamn
Five game days later, the newspaper delivery boy comes in. Random heroes kill evil villain. Wow, can I buy this? I don't know. That's deeply character impacting. Right, let's
what did you do last session? We stood around the bar. What did your characters do? Oh, they leveled up 3 times.
They saved the world.
So guideline number 2 was use some common sense in terms of the NPCs you choose to jump in. Guideline number 3 is when playing one of these NPCs, remember that what you're trying to do is add life and color to the situation. You're trying to help build the scene. Keep your actions surface and colorful. Your job is not to reveal plot information or to do things that are really under the purview of the game master. Once again, as I said, all 3 guidelines fall under the single heading of no one respect the game master in the way that they run a game.
Let me ask you a question. What happens when the player falls in love with the NPC? They jump into this NPC. It's just some side guy. It's going to be there and gone. Just a little thing on the side. You know, a little something, something. Not the true interest. You know what I mean. But you stay there. You kind of get to know them. And you get a little too intimate. Get a little too close. And now you don't want to leave them. This other character that you have... Yesterday's news. You just want to cast him aside.
First of all, I don't think you're going to get to that extreme. But... with what you
I have
as a player character,
as a game master, somebody that happened in one of my
games. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, I stand corrected. Anything can happen. But what I swear to God,
it was a used car salesman.
That's cool. An example from what I've done in the past, though, is what happened in the game is a certain NPC got played like that, and that PC became that NPC became memorable, so it became a somewhat recurring NPC. Let's say in more normal situations, other than the extreme case that you're talking about, Chad, I think that's what's going to happen. I think most of the time, it's going to be, you played the shopkeeper, you played the patron, you played whatever. It's forgotten as soon as it's over with. But sometimes you might have a really memorable one. Maybe, you know, Wayne does it. He jumps in. He does a fantastic job with his character. Very memorable. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, yeah. Everybody responded well.
We are talking fantasy.
Well, it's fantasy role playing. So there you go. They come back, down the road. And when they do, the parts are like, oh, it's so-and-so. Awesome. You know, hey.
I think if that happens, you've got one of two other problems already occurring. Either the player's not satisfied with their character, or you have someone who's way too easily moved by the new shiny. In which case, you've probably got a bigger issue already worked there.
NPC just turned out to be more interesting.
I get
something. Well, yeah. In this example, maybe. It wasn't this sort of smooth transition that we've been talking about here. This was my last group, and we didn't really do this. What happened was he was playing a character who had become incapacitated, and the realism of the thing was that his character was incapacitated for several days. And he really couldn't play him. And so I'm like, well, here, just use this NPC, this contact that everybody kind of liked, that the party liked and was interacting with the party a lot. He's not really important. He's not the big bad or anything like that. Here, you play him. And so he started playing him, put his own spin on it, and was like, I really like this guy. It's really interesting. And it got to the point where his original character got better, and it was just sort of a natural thing. I don't even think we even talked about it. He didn't stop playing the other guy, and his character became an NPC.
Really fine with that.
Yeah, I have no problem.
In games that I've played and ran, no problem.
Yeah,
you like that one more? Welcome to your new character.
Yeah, I think I would handle that the same way I would any other character transition. I mean, there's 100 reasons why someone may fall out of love with their current character or fall in love with a new character concept and want to switch. And I would handle it the same way I'd handle any of those situations. In this case, if he's a contact the party's already familiar with and he's already following him around, clearly he fits into the group template. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's who you're playing. Your main character died on the table in recovery.
Yeah.
And
I didn't kill him.
I'm being facetious, but my point being that I think you could transition it just as easily.
And what I've actually done in situations similar to that is almost swap the places of the two characters so that what used to be their PC becomes a secondary recurring character.
Right.
Kind of like what Pat was saying. They might pop up every now and again and maybe either in control of the original player or the DM, just depending on circumstances. But that's no longer primary character.
Yeah.
You know, the new one is the primary. The other one has now receded into NPC-dom. They lost the giant P stamp on their head.
That's like the reverse of one of our sort of GM tools. Bad characters become great bad guys. Good characters become great NPCs.
Yeah, they do. And great NPCs become even better characters.
Mm-hmm. And even better characters soon become very deep bad guys. But where were we going?
And elves become cyborgs.
Well, that's a given. Oh. I mean, we all knew that. Oh.
All right.
And drow become very good and troubled about their inner turmoil. And so then they get a second scimitar.
So a second panther.
What,
and,
what sex is that cyborg, though, Dan?
Whatever you want, Pat.
Okay, it's an elf.
Said the elves.
It's an elf. Cyborgs,
so. Therefore, we've covered this already.
Yeah, we've covered this already. They have two genders. So,
and either one should be fine for you.
Brief mention, if you haven't already, get signed up for Fear the Con at fearthecon.com. No major announcements on that this week, except to say that it's still coming and it's still going to rock. And we want to thank you.
I'm strongly going to be considering Bronchosaurus Rex. I can come up with a story for one.
I'm actually running a third game at Fear the Con.
Oh, are you?
Yes, I have actually dropped out of Chris May's game because I really wanted to run a game in slot 6. And actually, on feartheboot.com, there is voting going on as to which one I'll run. Either
it would take an act of God in Congress to get me out of Chris May's
game. Oh, I'm sure. Game. I'm sure.
Mink is coming back, and he's coming back with a pimp hand strong. So
yes.
Thank you guys for tuning in, and you guys have a great week and good games, and we will catch you next week.
Salancha.
And Willie, thanks for the scotch.
Bye, Willie.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.